from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, July the 9th, 2020, and we have a good show lined up for you today. We're going to be speaking first off with Lucy Larish of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England about a U.S. Supreme Court decision yesterday that exempts religious universities and schools and other employers actually from providing health coverage for contraceptives to their employees. And people very worried about what the results will be on that for healthcare out there. In the second half hour, we're going to be speaking with Roger Hill, the famous WDEV meteorologist. He's going to be talking to us about, I saw some news the other day that we are in the grip, most of the country is in the grip of a serious heat wave. No end in sight. Vermont's been pretty hot lately. So we'll talk about that. And I also want to check in with Roger about this Saharan dust cloud that's had more of an impact in the southern U.S. than up in this part of the world. But also a weather phenomenon worth remarking on, I think, and we'll see what Roger can tell us about that. Later on in the program, after a brief conversation with Leonard Steinhorn of CBS News about campaign 2020, we will be shifting over to Matt Dickinson, political science professor from Middlebury College, and he'll be talking with us about a lot of different aspects of the current political scene out there. And as always, we welcome calls from listeners, and that's the nature of a talk radio show. So let's get right into it with Lucy Larish of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. Lucy hasn't been on the show in a while, but has a couple times previously in my tenure here, and I appreciate you coming back. Lucy, thanks very much for joining me.
Oh, of course. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yep. And so this decision yesterday from the U.S. Supreme Court, tell us from your understanding what it does. And I gather you see some problems with it. At least that was what I got from the statement issued by Planned Parenthood yesterday. And so let's just give a primer for folks who haven't seen much reporting on this yet.
Yeah, sure. So the case is Trump versus Pennsylvania. And basically, right now, the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, requires coverage for contraception. What this rule does, the Trump rule that the Supreme Court examined and put an opinion out on Wednesday, yesterday, the Trump rule puts into the Affordable Care Act a religious or moral exemption for businesses or universities to be able to say they don't want to include contraceptive coverage in the insurance that they provide, the health insurance that they provide to their employees. So the ruling came out in Trump's favor, and now employers across the country will, in a very large scale, will be able to decide under citing this moral or religious objection to remove birth control coverage from their health insurance and essentially take away birth control from their employees.
And in the case of universities, this applies to student health plans, I gather?
That's correct.
And so that's why universities are sort of brought into the separate category, because many of them do provide student health coverage, and as part of sort of a package of ancillary benefits and so on you get for going to the university.
Right, exactly.
I had that kind of coverage when I was a student. So,
yeah, so did I.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, do you have a sense of how many people, how many individuals out there are likely to be affected by this decision?
Well, it's very hard to put your finger on the number of that. I can tell you that right now, the Affordable Care Act covers more than 62 million women, and that includes 17 million Latinas and 15 million Black women in the nation. So, it's I think the impact could be really huge. Vermont, however, oh yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, in terms of the, I'm trying to get a good, accurate picture of the kind of universe of folks who are affected here. And one question is, so does this affect people who get their insurance under the Affordable Care Act, or does it affect them plus people in sort of private health care plans? You know, I'm covered right these days by Blue Cross Blue Shield through my wife's employer. We don't get ACA coverage. Could if my employer wanted, or if my wife's employer wanted to, could they suddenly say, hey, Blue Cross, we're not paying you anymore for contraceptive coverage? Or is this just ACA folks?
So there are actually two things I want to address with that. So the first is that you're a Vermonter, and Vermont, I'm sure you'll want to talk about what this means for Vermont specifically. But
yes.
The other question about whether or not this applies just to the Affordable Care Act, that is correct. This ruling was specifically about the Affordable Care Act, the religious exemption in the ACA.
Okay. And again, I don't mean to minimize it or anything. I'm trying to get a sort of a sense who most is going to be impacted by this. And I suppose these are folks who are getting insurance from their employers, but it's actually under the rubric of the Affordable Care Act. And so I'm wondering, one of the long-term sort of debates surrounding birth control, or what the points the people who defend birth control like to make, is that easy access to birth control, ready access to birth control, can help hold down the rates of abortions in the United States or anywhere. They're flight, I suppose, and oftentimes the people who are most eager to limit access to birth control are also those who are most opposed to abortion. And so talk to me a little bit about what would seem to be, on the surface anyway, a bit of a contradiction there.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think I would like to describe that as compulsory pregnancy. There are folks who, for whatever reason, feel that they have the right to make that decision for somebody else. And because they don't believe in birth control or don't believe in abortion, they feel like no one should have access to an abortion and no one should have access to birth control. And I think that is unfortunately it's a very outdated, misogynistic point of view and belief to hold, that you can control somebody's life, future, and body. It's such a personal decision whether or not someone wants to use birth control or to have an abortion.
And I can almost hear right now. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if the phone starts ringing any minute at 244-1777. That's the local number in Waterbury, or 1-877-291-825, our toll-free number. Wouldn't be surprised if somebody calls up and says, well, you know, if you want to make a decision not to have a child, the best way to do that is not to have sex. And I mean, I'm sure you've heard that before as well.
Sure.
What is your retort to that?
Well, I think that's true. I think no sexual activity is absolutely the most effective form of birth control. But in the end, human biology, like every other species on the planet, human beings have evolved over a long period of time to reproduce, sexuality is a very, very fundamental, hardwired part of being human. And just saying that someone just shouldn't have sex is, I think, a bit naive and unrealistic, because we all know that human nature is that sexual impulses are very strong, and that sexuality is a very strong part of being human. It's just a natural part of life. And so those who deny sexuality, I think, are kind of missing. I think it's Well, it's denial, simply denial of being human.
And not really living in the real world, I guess, would be one way to describe it. Because people do have sex, that is for sure. And sometimes that can result in a pregnancy which is not welcome. And one of the things that birth control is designed to do is to prevent that. And so... And this decision, of course, just to be clear, didn't touch on the abortion issue per se. It was strictly about birth control. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So this is this ruling is strictly about birth control.
Now, I wonder if you know anything about sort of what the supporters of this decision expect. In terms of practical applications here, do employers then call insurers and say, we want to have the menu of services you cover? You know, you'll cover it if somebody is injured, got hit by a car, or has a heart attack, or you'll cover it if somebody develops an illness that results in big medical bills and so on. But we don't want you to cover somebody who is going to see their doctor about getting on the pill or getting an intrauterine device or any of the other sort of common forms of birth control. And the insurance companies are expected then to basically be able to sort of suss that out and figure out how much the cost is of those portions of their coverage and then subtract that from the bill. Is that how it works?
Yeah. When you're looking at a pool of insurance, I think what my understanding is that the cost of contraceptive coverage is really like many fractions, like a minuscule part of a percent of 1% of the cost of an actual healthcare premium, a comprehensive healthcare premium. So this is not going to save anyone money in any real way. This is an ideological attack on women and women's ability to control their lives. We know that birth control is the single most important, access to birth control is the single most important factor that can really help a person make decisions about their life and also their economic standing in the world, their ability to survive and to find economic stability.
And just so I understand, you mentioned a couple times now this is an attack on women and their access to birth control. Does this ruling have any effect on vasectomies?
No. It does not. So vasectomies are not, as far as I know, Viagra. And Viagra, what about Viagra? Let's talk about erectile dysfunction medication that would, and vasectomies. No, as far as I understand, this ruling is about birth control and is not, it's silent on sterilization.
Wow. Vasectomies are oftentimes, I think most folks know this is a surgical procedure, outpatient surgical procedure men get so they avoid impregnating women. And that strikes me as a form of birth control, isn't it?
It's actually considered sterilization for the purposes of insurance and insurance coverage and how it's looked at in your policy or how it's labeled in your policy. It's considered sterilization as opposed to birth control.
Do you sympathize with my difficulty in understanding the distinction here?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is hypocrisy at its greatest. We have. And that is why I say this is misogynistic and this is clearly an attack on women, because there's nothing within the Supreme Court ruling and nothing within the Trump rule that would affect men in any negative way. There's nothing in there that would take away anything, any of the rights or privileges or services that men now have.
Wow. Okay. So that's quite an odd situation. I mean, I've known
actually,
people.
I'll take that back. Yeah. That is actually not true because condoms would be included as birth control. So condoms would therefore not be covered. But then that is also, I think, that is also more about getting it's homophobia and anti-LGBTQ as well. Because we know that gay men and use condoms mostly to protect themselves from sexually transmitted infections.
But I would gather that the vast majority of condom sales actually are to heterosexual men who are, again, just trying to avoid getting someone pregnant. By sort of the demographic makeup of society or whatever. So, I shouldn't laugh, but this is. And we're in the sort of Alice in Wonderland territory here. It almost seems.
This is Handmaid's Tale material right now.
I had my literary reference wrong there, but and again, birth control. I mean, it would be interesting to know. I don't think you could ever get to this, but sort of how many abortions have been prevented by birth control.
The Guttmacher Institute has that data.
Really?
Do not, unfortunately, have that on the top of my head, but I believe the Guttmacher Institute has been able to create an algorithm to figure that out.
Okay.
But it's huge.
I mean, again, we're talking about some pretty, has struck me for a long time as pretty commonplace stuff here, folks. We're not on the bleeding edge of anything, really. And to kind of go backwards from the standards that have been in place pretty routinely for decades now, one would think, I don't know, probably not real helpful. But I'm curious to know
about it. Your boss gets to decide whether you get birth control. I mean, just let that sink in for a minute. Your boss gets to decide whether or not you can have birth control in a covered healthcare benefit. That is an overreach beyond.
I generally think that the proper relationship with the boss is to say, the boss provides salary and some benefits, and the worker provides work, and if the work is good enough, the relationship continues, and we leave it at that. Keep things simple. This sort of raises another weird question, though, which is, we hear in other contexts that many, many employers around the country are bringing along female employees in their workforce and putting them in line for promotions and various things and, people developing their careers, et cetera. If they happen to be a woman, a lot of employers are not real excited about having to deal with women who get pregnant. So, they can voluntarily say, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I think what you're pointing at is a really important point, and that is that women have struggled and fought for a long time to find parity and equity in the workforce, and we're still not there in terms of pay and so on. And a lot of it, I think, has come from male-run companies and businesses feeling like, oh, no, I can't hire a woman because she's just going to get pregnant. And so here we are. We are once again going backwards and putting women in a position where we're, once again, the playing field already is not level, and we are creating even more of a slope, an uphill slope for women to be able to survive and provide for themselves or their families. They are at a huge disadvantage in the workplace, like in the job market, and then once again in the workplace.
Yeah, and a lot of it, I mean, not all of it certainly, but some of it stems from the fact that women, you know, if you're an employer and you're looking at a male candidate for a job or a female candidate for the job, you're not supposed to do this, but somewhere in the back of your mind is probably the thought that the female candidate, you know, assuming she's in childbearing years and so on, could get pregnant, and that is an issue in many, many workplaces, of course. And just to be clear, this this ruling from the Supreme Court is a it doesn't make it's not required that employers not offer comprehensive or not offer contraceptive coverage as part of their comprehensive coverage. It merely says employers and universities are allowed to try not to offer contraceptive coverage, correct? It's permissive
permissive as opposed to a mandate. That's correct.
Right.
But it's once again, it's just another step. It's another step closer to, controlling women, controlling women's bodies and futures.
Let me bring in a caller. I believe Rama is on the line from Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Good morning. I got to tell you, these horrible women, they have periods and babies and stuff and want to be treated like human beings, you know. Gosh.
Can you imagine? Oh, my word.
It really is terrible. Hey, listen, we have really perverted these constitutional amendments and make no law regarding establishment of religion or shall not interfere with the free exercise of, and we've turned it into where the public has to act as religion dictates now. And the simple truth is, we have, because there's been a determined effort over the years, we've reached a point where organized religion is dictating public policy. And that is absolutely wrong. And we've done it because various groups have pushed to have justices put on the Supreme Court with very specific intents. Some of it has been to expand the power of organized religion over our lives, and some of it has been to expand, guns anywhere, anytime, for any reason. And it's just really starting to fray. It is starting to tear us apart from this democratic institutions and the secular institutions that our country was founded upon. So that's basically what I want to say. We got to stop pandering to organized religion and just say, listen, if you want to accept the benefits of society, then you have to accept the same rules everybody else has to live with. If you don't want to accept the benefits of society, you can do what you want, period.
Okay. Rama, thanks for the call. I got your point. And let's go to Eileen in Jericho. Good morning, Eileen.
Hi. I don't want to do this. First of all, I want to say that there's been no mention so far of the women who brought this to the court, the Little Sisters of the Poor, who are going to be forced out of business to do what they do, which is to serve the poor, if they didn't violate their religious beliefs. Some people in this world still have principles, and this is something they didn't feel like they should pay for. And there's no mention of all this garbage she's talking about with going backwards with women. This had nothing to do with keeping anyone from birth control. The Little Sisters of the Poor didn't want to pay for it at birth control in their, in their insurance.
How much was their budget for it?
I'm sorry?
How much were they paying for it on an annual basis?
I have no idea. You know what? I really don't feel up to this call, but I feel like I have to defend just all the... Never mind. And then why should... why should Americans be forced to pay by their government for things in their insurance they don't want to pay for? Why should we be forced anything from our government that has to do with health insurance? You know, you're talking about controlling women and blah, blah, blah. It's like, how about controlling Americans? You know, we didn't want this Obamacare, a lot of people. And it got forced on us. You know, and this is not keeping birth control from anyone. This is about paying for birth control in our insurance, or you know, which should be private insurance. And, you know, it's just maddening to hear this stuff. Sorry. I don't feel up to details about the case. I'm not a lawyer. It's just really, as a Catholic woman, it's just hard to hear the stuff coming out of Planned Parenthood's mouth. You know, from someone from Planned Parenthood, and not everyone feels like they feel. And I'm sorry, I really can't say anymore because I don't know the details. But I mean, okay. Why should, you know, there's been no mention of the Little Sisters of the Poor, who are women being forced. They're going to be forced to close what they do, and that is to serve the poor with their beliefs in Jesus Christ. That's what they should be doing. Why should they be forced to close down? Thank you.
Okay, well, I still haven't established really that they are forced to close down by this, but thanks for the call, Eileen. Lucy Larish, that's why I was asking about the actual cost. You know, what percentage of their health insurance is attributable to contraceptive coverage? It's true that under any health plan, isn't it, that if someone feels as though they don't want to they don't want to take advantage of a service that's offered on your healthcare menu, then they don't have to. Is that right? I mean, the patient choice and all that.
I think the basic concept of health insurance, is to have a risk pool that's large enough to absorb the cost of care.
Yep.
And so
hey, Lucy, I hate to do this, but I've got to cut you off because we're about out of time for this segment. But I really appreciate your participation this morning. Thanks for joining me today.
Okay.
Lucy Larish of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. And we're going to go to a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show for some bottom of the hour CBS News. We'll be back in a few minutes, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
My next guest is Roger Hill. I think most listeners to WDEV have heard this name before. Roger has been the WDEV meteorologist since, since they carved Mount Rushmore or something. Roger, good morning. How are you doing? Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, good morning, Dave Graham. You're welcome. Let's see. I think I started with Radio Vermont back in 1998, and then I'd had a couple years stint with the National Weather Service where I wasn't doing anything, and I came back. So it might have been 96. I can't remember exactly. But
okay, so the late 90s.
Wow, yes.
You go back a good 20-something years, and that's getting to be a career, my friend.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, it's kind of a niche kind of deal here. Of course, I do a lot of other stuff, but yep. Radio Vermont's a big part of that, and most people know me, of course, from Radio Vermont doing
sure.
the podcast on DEV and other things. But
Well, there have been a couple of interesting weather stories recently that I just wanted to. Dig into a little bit with you. The first one is I just saw a headline the other day talking about how pretty much the entire country has been in the and will remain for a while, or at least most of it will remain for a while in the grip of an unusually intense heat wave, even for summer. I mean, we think of summer as hot weather and so on, but this is going to be a really hot one.
Yeah, this is a. There's indications of a what looks like a kind of almost a. People are kind of letting it go now and calling it a killer heat wave. And this is not in our neck of the woods, but we'll probably see some of the effects sort of indirectly. But this is setting up over Texas and then back into Arizona. Okay, Arizona, New Mexico, the desert Southwest. We normally think of it as pretty hot anyway, but when it's extra hot over that particular area, it starts getting, you know, ridiculously hot to the point where it could be life-threatening. And the worst of it looks to be like over New Mexico and sort of the western half of Texas. But this is what we call a heat dome. These are big, broad areas of higher pressure. And the higher pressure, when it sits over one particular area, just basically it doesn't allow for a lot of cloud cover. It doesn't allow for a lot of any kind of precipitation. So you have sinking motion, or what we call subsidence, in the atmosphere, and that compresses the air to even become more hot. And it kind of reinforces itself. And when a big heat dome sets up, it's really hard to sort of dislodge these. You have to have a kind of a special big change that goes on, you know, where there's a lot of things going on, say, much further to the north or further to the south. In this particular case, it looks like we're going to be stuck with it. So some really hot weather coast to coast. And sometimes you can get relief out of these really hot kind of scenarios where a little bit later in the season, roughly about now, and then points into the fall, these also kind of go hand in hand with tropical cyclone development. Because of the water temperatures, of course, across the Atlantic are maxing, and they'll be maxing out around early to mid-September. And all of that in play right now with, of course, tropical cyclones developing and what could be a pretty phenomenal hurricane season for the Atlantic Basin for 2020.
Wow. Now, that makes me think about the other story, or one of the other stories I wanted to delve into with you, because I saw a reference in a piece I read about something called the Sahara Dust Cloud, that the Sahara Dust Cloud, which has been circling the planet and has been affecting the southern United States, the Caribbean Basin, parts of Mexico and northern South America, I guess, actually, so, you know, right, basically right in the hurricane belt there. This dust cloud tends to have a suppressive effect on tropical storms. What do you know about that?
Yeah, so this is, you know, we've been kind of dealing with this probably for the last maybe 2-3 decades now, where in the Sahara Desert and the climate that's just a little bit to the south that they call the Sahel or Sahel. Which is mixes in with a little bit of tropical moisture coming in from sort of Central Africa. That particular area, when there's big time dust storms, sandstorms for them, really, the dust, the smaller micron level particulate carried over makes it into the oftentimes the Western Atlantic, and then we'll take a track sort of toward the very northern portion of South America, but a lot of Central America, including the Caribbean, and as you were just talking about, once in a while it makes it to Florida and the Southeast United States. It's very rare for that to see that make it all the way to Mexico and then drop out into the Pacific. And that actually happened back about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. And so the dust clouds that have been coming off of West Africa, and they blow basically west to east, east to west. It's the opposite of what we see mostly in our weather up here. So that's where also big hurricanes develop. And so when you have that dust cloud, it has a tendency to cause this big sinking motion, just like what I described with a big heat dome. It's the same kind of thing, where it basically suppresses the subsidence, the sinking air, will not allow the formation of tropical cyclone development over those areas that are heating up in the ocean. And so dust clouds kind of go hand in hand with not a whole lot of tropical cyclone activity. And we have the combination of the two. Everything looks like it's going to be a fairly potent hurricane season, but what's kind of throwing some curveballs into the early part of that is these big dust clouds coming in off the Sahara Desert.
Yeah, that is fascinating. So how long do we expect this dust cloud condition to continue? Could it last into, you know, September, October, and basically act as a break, or to some extent, on what would otherwise be maybe a very, very difficult tropical storm season?
Yeah, it's kind of the information that I've seen. I have not seen any other studies on this, but The information that I've seen is that this will probably start to wane. That is the dust, the amount of dust that's coming off the Saharan Desert in West Africa and then heading across the Atlantic Ocean toward us. Mm-hmm. This will start to wane, and when that does, that's when we'll probably see a lot more tropical cyclone development. All of a sudden, we could, you know, see, you know, one, two, three or four systems all at once, you know, working over the Atlantic. We're not seeing that right now. We do have one system that's going to try to, it's more of a what we call a homegrown kind of system that local to the Carolinas. It actually formed in the south of the panhandle of Florida and then cut across the panhandle into Georgia, into South Carolina, and then it just most recently dumped off the Carolina coast or really close to the coastline. It looks like it's going to take a track in the Outer Banks and then work up toward us. And a little bit later on this afternoon, there's going to be a hurricane reconnaissance aircraft that's going to be flying back and forth and trying to get some better snapshots of analysis so that they can make a better projection on the path and the intensity. If or not, it could be a tropical storm, Faye. The chances are it'll probably be a depression. Now, for us, getting up here, normally we wince when we hear about, there's a tropical cyclone heading up the coast. But boy, under a drought scenario, this could be very beneficial for us, and so it might actually be in our favor to see this tropical depression work into our neck of the woods.
Bringing some rain.
Bringing some much-needed rain. That's the whole deal. Get the water tables back up to where they should be, and it's kind of piecemeal. You know, a lot of places are very, very dry. Other places have received a ton of rainfall, so it's a little kind of Swiss cheese out there, but what would really give us a widespread rainfall would be a tropical storm system, and we don't want the winds. Obviously, we don't want too much all at once. Storms, as we know, can bring 3, 4, 5, 6 inches. Flash flood guidance, typically anything over about 3 inches can start to overload the system in terms of our headwaters, our streams and rivers and whatnot. But this looks like it's going to be well under that. So it could be very beneficial for us if it does happen.
When are we expecting to see this weather?
Interestingly, it looks like on Saturday, and I know there's a big rally taking place in New Hampshire on Saturday, so mm-hmm. We'll see if that's going to be changing things up. I don't know. I don't see the system strong enough to do that, but it looks like over the weekend, with the best chance somewhere along about Saturday, it could be that the storm tracks a little too far to our east to get really beneficial rains. But if it tracks a little bit closer to, say, New Hampshire or right over us, it looks like we'll probably see it. Get the rainfall.
Yeah. And as you say, a lot of people are thirsty for some rainfall in these parts of Vermont. It seems like just very anecdotally from, you know, basically my own experience, we have had some showers here lately around, you know, Montpelier, but not enough really, I guess, to offset what folks are saying is, I mean, we've had very few what we used to think of as rainy days. You know, it used to be you'd get a rainy day and it pretty much, you know, rained with varying degrees of intensity all day. And that doesn't seem to be happening lately.
Yeah, a good, you know, light to moderate soaker would be probably the best of all worlds. It just basically soaks into the ground, doesn't do as much runoff. But as we know, any kind of tropical system and with the kind of water in the air that we have, the kind of moisture we have right now, supports these big, fat water droplets. And they hit the ground, splash, a lot of it, instead of soaking into the ground, just runs off. The other thing that's kind of interesting is the drier we get, the harder it is, let's put it this way, the harder it is to saturate the ground, and so it contributes to more runoff. And that's, you know, you think back to, you hear about the deserts and flash flooding and whatnot, and it's kind of like raindrops that hit this sandy deserts and whatnot. We think, okay, it would absorb really quickly. It really doesn't do that, and everything's so parched and baked that it doesn't allow it to absorb into the soil. So it becomes all runoff, and that's why we hear flash flooding, you know, don't camp in a desert arroyo, you know, a desert wash, because oftentimes people get in trouble and it causes fatalities all over the southwestern deserts, for example.
Yeah, that I have heard and read that you wouldn't think of, you know, someplace like New Mexico or Arizona being flood prone, but actually they are more so than would be probably just anybody would have the hunch, first impression. So very interesting. And I'm wondering, the heat dome that you talked about, and the story I saw the other day, pretty much talked about the entire continental U.S. being locked in a heat wave for much of July, and you know, looked like they were predicting into August as well. Talk to us a little bit. I know you're very concerned about climate change, and so I mean, is this anything related to that, or is it really not enough data to make that connection, or where are we on all that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of nuances to it. So where it's getting drier and hotter under climate change, it gets even more drier and more hotter, and that kind of feedback cycle sets in. Also under climate change, those areas that have a tendency to see a lot of storms, if they're in a position where they have enough moisture inflow, you know, from a source of like the Atlantic Ocean or the Great Lakes or wherever, things will get wetter and go the other direction. And we've seen both. We've seen summers that are just so wet and, you know, tremendous amounts of rainfall. Like if you remember June of 2019, it seemed like it would never, we couldn't get a sunny day if we, you know, begged for one. And we had a ton of rainfall. That was kind of in that wet feedback mode. And then things kind of flipped as we went into July and August and kind of turned dry last summer. This year it's dry from the get-go. And, of course, it followed a very cold, fairly late spring. And anyway, climate change, the play in that and how the jet stream is configured has a lot to do with what's going on up in the Arctic and the loss of sea ice. That loss of sea ice is contributing to unusual jet streams that kind of the configuration, the storm tracks kind of rearrange themselves to such a position that there's almost equal amounts of sort of north-south flow as there is what we call meridional flow from west to east. When you get that kind of stuff, you get big stark changes. Right now, it's basically heat all the time. And like you said, it's basically coast to coast and also affecting a good portion of southern Canada. But you get further to the north of that, and that's where the jet stream is. And occasionally that jet stream will be strong enough with a little shortwave trough. That trough, that little dip, will then make it down occasionally into the lower 48 United States, mainly northern areas. The hope is that we can see that, and it looks like one of those changes, as a matter of fact, is heading our way for this coming weekend and next week. So for us, the heat ridge, the heat dome, is going to be pushed, and it's more semi-permanent off to the south and west of us and not exactly over the northeast United States, at least northern New England. Now, places like Boston, the I-95 corridor, and then back down to the south of us, they're not going to see the relief that we're going to see up here. So we're still a little bit on the lucky side of things, but, you know, as the climate warms, pretty soon we'll be in New York's position and New Jersey and Washington, D.C. and so forth, as the heat ridges will be expanding and becoming more and more semi-permanent in our neck of the woods as well.
I do believe we have a listener who's calling in, Marsha from Barrie. Good morning, Marsha.
Morning, Dave, and morning, Roger.
Good morning.
I have two questions. One is, I wish you could give pollen counts, and I'm thinking perhaps your forecast area is too large, but I sure wish you could add the pollen counts to your forecast.
Yeah, that's a data set that's hard to come by, and it's kind of very general. And I'm going to look more into that, but that is something, especially in the spring. Can I ask you a question, Marsha? Are you affected by pollen most recently?
Yes,
on Monday
there was a big jolt of pollen. On Monday, but I tend to get things in the spring and then a little bit on and off in the summer, but then the ragweed comes and that's my big time. But the spring is actually worse for me.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to relate to, so if you think about, you know, pollen floating in the air, this is, you know, a natural process that has to happen. And when it's floating in the air, these particulate pieces of pollen that affect so many people, when it's very, very dry, we've had a very dry late spring and into the summer, the pollen doesn't come down because it doesn't get rained out. So consequently, it's kind of a cumulative process in the lower atmosphere. Kind of just build that pollen up, and until we get in, you know, some rain like we had yesterday, it never really washes everything out. So that may be by the contribution of pollen may be very high up until yesterday, and you might be suffering from the effects of that up till yesterday. Now, if there's no noticeable change, it may not be that it's pollen. So I just wanted to add that to it. But at the same time, in the springtime, when the pollen counts are super-duper high to the south of us, and yet things aren't really even leafing out here, sometimes you can get that pollen way further to the north, where there's nothing really homegrown or local that's being, that's pushed out of the foliage or whatever. And so consequently, it's deceiving. You can get really high counts of pollen sometimes well before we even see anything greening up around our neck of the woods. It all depends on the flow of air and then also the lack of rainfall. If you get a lot of precipitation, of course, that's going to wash the pollen out.
Okay. Interesting.
May I ask one more question?
Sure. What's your second question, Marcia?
There was some kind of a big study last year, which about the increase in stratocumulus or cumulostratus clouds, and which was an indication of climate change. And I was wondering if you know about this study and what are the effects?
Yes, I heard about the study. I haven't read it verbatim, but I think it goes to the fact that the more clouds over the ocean will reflect back into outer space, the incoming shortwave radiation will be outgoing longwave radiation. And what that does is if there's no clouds, it has a tendency to heat the Earth a lot faster with climate change. If the clouds are created, and they're generally higher, the higher clouds, those are the more reflective type clouds, that then sort of reflects that energy from the sun outward again as long-wave radiation. And they can measure both of these and sort of see the incoming and the outgoing. With climate change, of course, we have a lot more incoming, and there's a lot less outgoing because of the global greenhouse effect, that mm-hmm. keeps the molecules dancing and then heating up the atmosphere accordingly. But the study that you're talking about, I believe, had a lot to do with the oceans, if I'm correct. But the higher, if you have a lot of high clouds, that actually reflects that incoming radiation a whole lot better than it does the lower clouds. The study, I think, referred to the fact that there is some indication that there's better reflection with the low stratocumulus clouds over the oceans, is what I remember hearing about.
Thank you, Raj.
Thanks for the call, Marcia. Appreciate it. Let's go to Chris in Waterbury. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, good morning, David.
How are you?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My question is, during this partial shutdown of the worldwide economy and what seemed to be some form of a partial healing process of the planet, has there been any information gathered by scientists and others to utilize that to try to help point us in a better direction as far as what we should be doing to combat this climate change issue?
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of stuff back on it, but I got to think that because of the fact that there's less people flying, for example, and there's less contrails, so therefore less cirrus clouds. 9/11, of course, was a big experiment when everything was shut down, and so they noticed that the temperatures across the lower 48 United States, I think even the planetary across the globe, they noticed that the temperatures were warmer. Because, again, it's just what we were talking about. The incoming solar radiation hits the cirrus clouds. When there's more cirrus clouds, it reflects it back out to space. And so the lack of economics and being allowed to fly has reduced, of course, the contrail activity. And so a little bit less cirrus clouds. And so all of that is kind of in play. The other thing is there's been a lot less common pollution due to the fact that we're not industries are not producing as much as they would otherwise and whatnot. So these are things that will probably be coming out in the future, a lot of different studies about that. I've heard only some anecdotal information here and there about that, but we're right now very much like looking back at 9/11 when we had that shutdown for a couple, 3 days. Right now we're looking at, a big time experiment, and this time it's planetary. And so it's very interesting right now to see what will be coming out with many of these studies. But I know there'll be some interesting highlights about that. And I've heard various, anecdotal things that it's actually causing warming with global warming because we're seeing less pollution, less soot particulate. It gets really kind of into the weeds on this, but long story short, when you have that sunshine and you have a little bit of a more of a smog or a haze, that reflects those particulates. And again, that incoming solar radiation is reflected back out in the outer space. All of a sudden, now you have no pollution. Well, everything starts warming up. And this is the filtering effect, if you will, of the upper atmosphere.
So what's the truth behind chemtrails then? Is there any?
The truth behind what?
Chemtrails.
No, there's no such thing. Well, if you want to look at, sure, there's chemicals being produced by jet engines. They burn a fuel, and that is your chemtrail. So,
got to interrupt, guys. Chris, I got to thank you for the call. Roger, thank you very much for being my guest this morning. We're about at the top of the hour, the end of this segment. We're going to go to a break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. CBS News coming up, and more of our show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, and my guest is Leonard Steinhorn. He's with CBS News, political consultant with the Tiffany Network. And Leonard, is it still called the Tiffany Network?
Oh my, I haven't heard that in a while. But I do think that the owner of Tiffany actually once owned CBS. So I think that's how they got it.
Oh, I see. Okay. Huh. Interesting. Well, definitely a classy outfit, and really appreciate your participation here. Campaign 2020 is your beat.
Trust me. Yeah, I don't have any Tiffany at my home, so apologies on that.
That's okay. You didn't have to show it to us. We're on radio. You could just start describing it with mellifluous words, and we'd all be our jaws would drop, and et cetera. But you're not faking it. That's the good thing about CBS. No fake news here. Hey, so I did want to check in with you about the campaign, and I mean, a couple of things that have struck me lately. One is that the president, in his remarks this past weekend, especially talking about the Confederate flags and how he thought it was a mistake for NASCAR to ban Confederate flags, claims their ratings have dropped. Who knows what ratings are these days with coronavirus and so on. But and then his remarks about Confederate statues and really railing on this so-called radical left for wanting to take some of the historic statues down and so on. Is that going to broaden his appeal or just really get his? I mean, is the object of the game here to merely intensify feelings among his base?
Well, outside of his base, and particularly his base of white folks in the South, I'm not sure that there's much of a constituency for Confederate heritage or Confederate history or Confederate monuments. And the question is why he's embracing the Confederacy, which basically was an open rebellion against the United States. That is not going to resonate very well with people in Wisconsin or Minnesota or Pennsylvania, except for those diehards who are really part of his base and see that as a symbol of ongoing defiance that they think President Trump represent. So I'm not so sure why he's going down that path. I think he has a bit more sort of a reasonable a chance of reaching people if he says, look, you know, okay, if you want to take on the Confederates, that's one thing, but why go after Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, you know, and say, you know, if you can't see them as central in our American story, then we have a real problem with, you know, how we see this country and the narrative by which we define this country. So I think in some ways, you know, he sort of overstepped to appeal to the most enthusiastic parts of his base, and that's not resonating with people, except for the base. Now, here's the other thing. If you want to instill fear among people that there's going to be this, you know, let's say left-wing cabal trying to take over America and impose its way on everybody, that may not resonate at a time when, A, it doesn't seem realistic, B, most of those protests that have been going on in cities have been absolutely peaceful, and C, if people are scared of anything, it's not people on either side of the of American politics. It's of the coronavirus pandemic. And if he's not facing the actual fear that people feel in their everyday lives, I think he's really missing an opportunity here.
Yeah, I guess the and it's interesting to me that trying to stoke the fears of you know, this left wing conspiracy or whatever he sees out there or wants people to see. I wonder, you know, what is that merely an effort to distract attention from, you know, the real issue, given that he has been not he's not getting a lot of points for his handling of the coronavirus, of the real fearful thing there. So maybe the effort here is to say, no, let's not fear that. Let's fear this other thing.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's sort of a confounding strategy because if the people who have been hemorrhaging from him are the sort of prototypical suburban voters, and they have been hemorrhaging from him for a lot of reasons over the years, coronavirus leadership or lack thereof being the latest, but also because they feel, A, he's sort of a bully. You know, imagine those suburban parents who teach their kids to, you know, stand up to bullies and not to accept bullying. And the same suburban parents say to their kids, you know, we have to live in a diverse society and respect each other. So if you want to reel those people back in, I'm not so sure embracing Confederate symbols is the way to do it, or even demonizing, you know, part of the political spectrum that many young people are, you know, whose parents live in those suburbs are associated with. But that being said, yes, he may be deflecting blame or deflecting on the issue, or maybe what he's doing is just trying to rouse up his base, figuring that there are enough of those core supporters that don't necessarily get registered in polls that will come out in higher and higher numbers, because whether they take him literally that he's supporting Confederate symbols, or seriously that he's basically sticking his thumb into the eye of the establishment, that they will double down on their support for him and go out to vote in high numbers with great enthusiasm. And in fact, the surveys do suggest that among Republican voters, there's very high enthusiasm to go out and vote for President Trump. And he must be seeing those numbers, because the more he can get his people motivated, you know, the more he thinks he has a chance to thread that electoral college needle, despite what all of the national polls are saying.
And Joe Biden, on the other hand, does he have a burden to try to come out and tell people, you know, I don't want to close down Mount Vernon or Monticello or, you know, the historic sites that are devoted to Washington and Jefferson, respectively, there, but also just other historic sites in the United States, which and if he does come out and he says something like, you know, look, every individual is a mix of behaviors. Yes, Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner. He was a man of his times and an affluent man of his times. He also wrote the Declaration of Independence and basically laid down the ideas when America eventually starts living up to them, slavery goes away, equality emerges, et cetera. So clearly a mix of conduct there in the course of Jefferson's life. Can Biden get a message like that out there without it being considered muddled and confusing and just too hard for to put on a bumper sticker?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Strategically right now, I'm not so sure he wants to take the bait from the president. Mm-hmm. I don't think he really wants to engage this. I think if he were asked, he'd probably shrug it off and say, of course, we shouldn't be honoring Confederates, people who, you know, sort of fought to maintain the enslavement of people, you know, people who rebelled and committed treason against the United States. Of course we shouldn't, and leave it at that. But then if a reporter asks him a question about, as you say, Jefferson or Washington, he might again try to shrug it off and said, of course we should respect the founders of our country. But if he's asked in a debate on this, I think your frame makes sense. The way I would be saying it is the following, is that, you know, we should be sort of rejecting, you know, any honor for certain people because of what they did, but we should still honor certain people in spite of what they did. So you reject Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis and Stonewall Jackson because of what they did, but you honor Thomas Jefferson and George Washington in spite of what they did because of the reasons that you laid out. And I think if he sort of articulated it that way, that would be easy for Americans to be able to grasp and understand, and it would help them sort of explain to themselves some of their own conflicting feelings about all of this in a very sort of short and pithy way. So he's going to be asked about that, no question, in the debates. But at this point, I don't think he wants to take the president's bait. I think he wants to keep focus, on what he will describe as President Trump's failure of leadership and divisiveness, and B, on the plans and policies that he wants to put forth if he were to become president of the United States.
Another aspect of Trump's campaign, and I wonder if you think it's sort of sticking, but I touched on it briefly a moment ago, but I really want to focus this question on kind of the fear that Trump is trying to point to, and you hear a lot of this on Fox News, frankly, also, that, you know, America's cities are being torn apart and burnt down and in turmoil, and there's all this violence and crime and et cetera, et cetera. And sure enough, there are some statistics out of some of our cities indicating a lot of kind of just routine crime and violence and shooting and that kind of thing, but not necessarily or really not at all tied to any political movement. Are those fears being exaggerated? Are they being accurately portrayed? Is there any way to sort of sort out, you know, kind of what's really going on there?
Well, I always talk to my students and say that there's a difference between accuracy and truth. And you can take something out of context and show it repeatedly, and it's accurate. You can show incidents that are outliers and show them repeatedly, and it's accurate what you're showing, even if you edit it in certain ways, but it may not be truthful for the whole story that's going on. And I think what the president and Fox wants to do is to sort of recreate that Richard Nixon 1968 campaign, where the country was falling apart. There was racial unrest and disruptions and riots in cities. There was crime that was hitting the country. There was a sense of chaos. And to be able to give people that feeling that if you don't have the strong leader who's going to push against the disorder, you know, we're going to be in trouble as a country. And if you keep showing the images of the bad things that happen and suggest that that's all that's happening, that's what you're trying to communicate to your voters. The question is whether the country has changed since 1968. I do think it has. And the other question is whether people are going to buy that narrative when they have access to so much other information beyond what was then, you know, three TV networks, a lot of Nixon ads and radio reports. And they have so much more access. And in so many ways, you know, the people that President Trump is trying to sort of make anxious are the same people whose kids are going out and joining Black Lives Matter protests and coming in back in home and saying how peaceful it was. So it becomes much harder for him to communicate all of this to the people that he wants to sort of evoke this sense of anxiety in. But I do think that they're trying to recreate that Nixon 1968 tableau of America, which is a tableau of fear and anxiety and disorder, that you need somebody strong and certain to be able to put it back in place. Again, it may work with his base, but if his base was far more representative of America in 1968, it may be far less representative of America today.
Yeah, I tell you, I had somebody call the show a couple weeks ago and try to say that all Black Lives Matter people were thugs. And it made me think of another guest I'd had on in the same period of time, who was a young woman and like 20 years old, a student at the University of Vermont, who was very involved in really a leader locally in the Black Lives Matter movement. And I just thought to myself, you know, this young woman, this student, is not a thug. So I think a lot of people get these blanket impressions or something, and I get, you know, one of my jobs, I guess, is to try to help sort that out. But there you go. And yours, too. And I really appreciate your help with that, Leonard Steinhorn of CBS News. Once again, I thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you.
Always happy to be on your show.
Alrighty. My next guest is Matt Dickinson from Middlebury College. He's a political science professor there and is becoming, I don't want to say quite a regular, because we have him on different days of the week and maybe not quite weekly, but he's been an occasional, at least somewhere between occasional and frequent guest, I guess. Looking for the right word here. Maybe he can provide it for us, but Matt Dickinson is a professor at Middlebury College, very insightful gentleman, and really appreciate him offering up some time for us this morning. Matt, good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Dave. Always glad to be with you.
And I wanted to check in with you just about the sort of state of the 2020 campaign and how things you see shaping up here. I've been particularly struck in recent days by the president really pushing back on things like NASCAR's decision to ban Confederate flags from their racing event, motor racing events, and his very strong defense of he doesn't want to see statues of Confederate generals taken out of town squares around the country, for instance. What's his strategy here, do you think?
I think he's trying to recreate the coalition that got him into the White House in 2016. I think when you think about how he is going to win in 2020, I think he thinks he's got to sort of pull that same electoral college magic where he may lose the popular vote. And that obviously was what happened in 2016. But if he can sort of pull the equivalent of a straight flush here, he can still eke out an electoral college vote. Electoral college victory, and that means mobilizing, particularly that same coalition of sort of middle to lower income, high school educated white voters that proved decisive in key states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, but also battleground states down south like Florida. So I think what you're seeing is the beginning of a campaign strategy formulated here in the open, in which he's trying to mobilize that group of voters.
Are there enough voters out there, though, who and maybe there are, I don't know for sure, but I'm trying to figure out whether the folks who really support and want to defend a symbol like the Confederate flag, do they outnumber, say, African Americans in the United States? African Americans plus, you know, anybody who believes that the Confederate flag is a symbol of of a past that we should much better leave behind?
I don't think those voters that he's appealing to do outnumber the people who find the symbols of the Confederacy offensive. But again, this is the difference between the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. Most African Americans are densely located in predominantly urban areas in what we would call blue states. They're going to vote, and they have historically voted Democrat, Democratic, and they will again in 2020. So he's not, if not writing them off, he's targeting a different set of voters. Now,
yeah.
I think you raise an important point, though. You know, this is a calculated strategy. It's a risky strategy because there's those sort of moderate independent swing voters who took a flyer on him in 2016 because they wanted to sort of get away from the Clinton dynasty choice, who might think, now, this is too much. This is too polarizing. This is too divisive. I want somebody sane and steady like Joe Biden. So you're absolutely right. There's no guarantee this is a great strategy, but I think it is the strategy he's adopted.
Might it be a default in the sense that it's really his only strategy that he has left, could he have selected another strategy and somehow made that work? I'm just trying to figure out whether kind of how on the spectrum of desperate to voluntary, where's the needle here?
Well, I think part of it is the candidate himself. I mean, this is not new for him. He's a counterpuncher. He's an attacker. He's engaged in divisive policies and statements even before he was a presidential candidate. And, you know, he spent much of Obama's presidency not even hinting, but sort of directly asserting that Obama, wasn't born in the United States, with the whole birther controversy. So this isn't new. I think part of this is who he is. The question is, that you raise is whether, you know, in translating his personal style into a campaign strategy, whether there's probably a better campaign strategy out there. I think, you know, you and I would probably agree that, yeah, there is. You might try to reach out and unify and bring sort of those independent moderates into the fold with less offensive strategy. I don't know if that's in his nature. And, you know, that's an interesting question.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, some news just breaking this hour, actually. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the federal prosecutor in Manhattan can see tax records, financial records of President Trump. They have not ruled yet but are expected to actually later today. I see in a Washington Post story on the question of whether congressional investigators can see these financial records that the president has been really very closely guarding throughout his presidency. What do you see as the impact of this decision of affecting the federal prosecutor in New York?
Well, I think this was sort of the tea leaves were signifying beforehand that this was going to happen, that the federal prosecutor, the argument that the prosecutor had a right to these tax records, I think that was a pretty solid case. I think it's less clear that the Democrats in Congress are going to get this. But it almost doesn't matter at this stage. It depends in part on what the tax documents have to say. I have all along been somewhat skeptical that this is going to be sort of a smoking gun, unless there's just something egregiously like, he declared taxes on the secret payments from the Russian government in 2016. I think what you're going to find is a guy who took advantage of every tax loophole there was, and he'll get some criticism for that, as people with money often do, and then it'll just sort of fade away. I just don't think this is going to be a huge issue, and I could be wrong on this.
Quick correction, by the way, for me. I got this wrong initially. It wasn't a federal prosecutor. It's actually Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus R. Vance Jr., who... He's a state prosecutor in New York, so I'm not sure that substantively that makes a huge difference, but I just wanted to make sure I've got my facts correct here, so apologies there. But this sort of two-track thing where the prosecutor in New York had been seeking these records, as congressional committees have as well. I believe the Ways and Means Committee, I hope I have that one right, has been in the lead on trying to seek financial records from the president and has been rebuffed so far. Does this morning decision foretell an afternoon decision, do you think?
Well, as I said, I think the afternoon decision, or if it is an afternoon decision, I think there's two different things here. The legal basis for the argument that the district attorney in New York gets these records is it's part of a criminal case. And I think it's all the legal experts, of which I'm not one, have said Trump was likely to lose that one. I doubt the same reasoning applies to having Democrats in Congress in their oversight capacity say they need his tax documents for years that he served, before he was even president. It's going to make that is a harder case, but I'm not even sure that's important unless the Democrats are going to use it as a pretext to launch another impeachment effort, which I suppose they could, although politically that's risky. I really think it's the criminal side we want to focus on here. And, you know, that if there's criminality involved there, that's going to be a problem for Trump.
Well, I want to ask one more question about that, but we have to head into a bottom of the hour break here for some CBS News and a couple of I've got 30 seconds left, so very quickly. Presidents are largely immune from criminal prosecutions. Can the prosecutor's office actually make any use of this?
Yeah, they can. I mean, again, it depends on the circumstances of what the case is. So this is a state level, so it's a slightly different.
All right, let's go to that break, and we can continue our conversation just afterward. We'll be back with more with Matt Dickinson of Middlebury College in just a few minutes. Folks, stay with us.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back, and my guest is Matt Dickinson. He is a political science professor at Middlebury College. And Matt, before we went to the break, we were talking about the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court today to say that the prosecutor in New York, District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr., can see tax and other financial records of President Trump. This has been a long-running legal battle, basically extending throughout the Trump presidency as to whether the president was going to release records. Congress is also after these records. So far, the court is silent on that, but they're expected to rule, according to the Washington Post, later today, whether committees of Congress can see the financial records of the president as well. And we were starting to talk about the sort of standard that the president is generally considered to be immune from criminal prosecution while in office, and this is a criminal case that the prosecutor has in New York, and I was asking you whether you think that any aspect of this case can really proceed, and now that they've received these records, if they find something in them that looks prosecutable. What happens?
So the issue here is one that's hotly debated, as you point out. The Justice Department's longstanding memoranda suggests you cannot indict a sitting president for a crime. Mm-hmm. You can impeach him. That's the alternative. So here's where, again, the Democratic Party in the House might pursue impeachment on the basis of evidence uncovered at the state level. Having said that, the additional issue then is, can you prosecute the president for these crimes once he steps down? And here the evidence seems to be you can. So that's why this is important. The other issue is there's always this longstanding concern among Trump's critics that, you know, he'll strike a deal and he'll get a pardon for crimes that he's committed or may have committed. But again, that pardon would only be for federal offenses. So if he is caught in a crime violating state tax policy, for instance, he can't be pardoned for that. So this is a potentially important ruling, even though the weight of the predominant of the evidence is consistent with the Justice Department that you cannot indict a sitting president, although, you know, not all legal scholars really buy that. It's still something of an open question, and it hasn't been resolved completely by the Supreme Court in previous cases.
This is the famous Office of Legal Counsel memo that was that played such a role in the in Robert Mueller's investigation of alleged alleged ties between the Trump campaign and some people working with the Russian government, and this really prevented a lot of analysts think prevented Mueller from really digging in and pursuing a prosecution there with gloves off, you know, and I wonder, I remember actually thinking that it would be a really, and I think I even said this online somewhere, that it would be a really good question for, this was back during the Democratic debates of last year when, you know, when we had nearly a couple dozen candidates up on the stage. I said, they ought to be asked, if you are elected president, will you ask the Congress to pass and then sign when it gets to your desk a law essentially nullifying the Office of Legal Counsel memo so that the principle of no person is above the law applies fully to the president? And I thought that would be a really good question to be asked. I don't remember it being asked. Do you?
No, I don't. And it would be a good question to ask.
The counter argument here is that if you allowed a president to be prosecuted as readily as any other citizen, you would end up with just a whole stream of politically motivated prosecutions of the president from day one of his or her term in office to the bitter end. Where do you come down on this? Do you think that there's good reason to say that the here's the new headline: the Supreme Court won't allow Congress to access the will not allow Congress to access the president's financial records. This is from the New York Times. Won't allow Congress to access President Trump's financial records for now, all but ensuring they won't be released before November. So that's as of the Congress now. This other headline indicating that the prosecutor could see them, I think, is a pretty sure. It definitely reduces the possibility of leaks. Would you say, or what do you think about that?
Well, okay. So again, this is breaking news, live radio.
Yeah.
This is yep. Great stuff here. So keep uh-huh. this in mind as I'm reacting as we go on the fly here.
Yep.
This is not
yep.
a surprise, right? 5 minutes ago, before the story broke, I suggested the court would not allow House Democrats to obtain his financial.
You're batting
records.
1,000 so far here, Matt Dickens.
Okay. It's been good talking to you, Dave.
Yeah, right. Let's leave it there, right?
I put a while on my hand here. But I'm going to wade into the thicket here since you've raised
okay.
it. It is live
yep.
radio.
Mm-hmm.
The issue here, I think, it's not simply a legal issue. There's also a political issue involved, which is, you know, is the possibility of entangling the president in countless what you might think frivolous lawsuits, is preventing that worth more than the opportunity to prosecute a president for what clearly seems to be a crime? And you can understand legal experts are really divided on this issue. You know, the famous, infamous statement that Trump said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and I wouldn't lose support. Well, he also wouldn't be indicted, according to the more extreme views.
Yep.
And I think a lot of people would say, well, that's wrong. And the response is, well, you can remove him by impeachment. And so that's the weapon the framers had in mind for a president who conducts conduct that is not fitting for the man in office. You remove him through impeachment. The difficulty is impeachment itself now has become such a partisan tool, as politics have become so partisan, is there's a difference on what is an impeachable offense. So these are hard issues. They're difficult issues. And I think the public generally is of two minds on this. If it's something that's viewed as primarily political, they don't want the president sucked into, you know, sort of legal machinations over this. But if it's a criminal prosecution, then, yeah, they want the president treated pretty much as any citizen. The difficulty is determining the distinction between the two, I think.
I wonder if there's a possible, I mean, this is just really blue sky thinking here off the top of my head, but is there a possible compromise here in which the Congress, maybe it's the Senate or could be maybe both would have to do this, but Congress votes on the question of do we remove the protection from the president from criminal prosecution in a certain case? So, in other words, the Congress, I mean, it would be, some people might see this as ducking, but let's say the Congress says, you know, we don't have the stomach to impeach the guy for cheating on his taxes. But we think that cheating on taxes is a bad thing, and it looks like there's pretty strong evidence that he did this. So we're going to vote to basically nullify the Office of Legal Counsel memo saying that the president can't be prosecuted, and then leave it to the prosecutors and the courts to determine. So there would be that sort of interim step of removing the protection from prosecution without actually convicting the president in an impeachment process. Could something like that come to pass, and would it make sense to you?
I think what it would do, as you alluded to at the beginning of that question, it would throw it into the courts and would see a reprise of the debate that we've seen already, which is trying to parse this language in the Constitution and in a way that says, yeah, he can be prosecuted for tax evasion. And I think it would be a lengthy battle, and I really don't know how the courts would come down on this. But it would be a first step, sure, and it would probably prompt a legal challenge. I just don't know how that legal challenge would play out.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you never know how. But I mean, in terms of kind of setting up the rules of the game, it just seems like here's another possible approach where, as a general rule, the president is exempt from prosecution, except if the Congress votes to remove that exemption.
Right. And the other quick point I would make here, Dave, is you know, the courts are historically reluctant to get involved in a battle between Congress and the president that is viewed as primarily political. So you might not even get a resolution on that.
Yeah, that's true. Who the heck knows? I mean, and that is kind of, that is pretty out there speculation. Hey, I wanted to get your thoughts about a column that I sent you this morning. It was by John F. Harris in Politico. And very compelling metaphor. I don't know if I agree with this or not, but I think that there is, it makes sense a little bit, and I'll just read the first couple of paragraphs to give people a sense of what Mr. Harris was talking about here. He says, probably you used to keep a bottle in your bathroom at home, or your parents did. The stuff is called Ipecac, and it's what physicians call an emetic. The idea was that if someone swallowed something bad, like poisonous plant or the wrong pills, they could be treated with a couple spoonfuls of this to induce something unpleasant but good, rapid and forceful vomiting. It is not intended as an insult to President Trump to observe that he is the political equivalent of Ipecac syrup. Looked at in a certain light, it is closer to a compliment. His supporters gave him power in 2016 because they believed the body politic was beset with toxins, an overdose of fecklessness and hypocrisy, and in need of a purge. Trump vowed to channel the contempt his supporters felt toward the established order and pledged plausibly to send the old order into a state of convulsive disarray. I remember back in college, friends occasionally talking jokingly and almost positively about what was sometimes referred to as worshiping the porcelain god. and basically that's what John F. Harris thinks has been going on politically here in this country. Matt Dickinson, what do you think?
Well, without embracing any particular metaphor or revealing my college experiences, I will say there is some sense of validity, I think, to the idea that Trump's election was a giant FU by the part of some people to the political establishment. I mean, he was running against another Clinton, and in the Republican primary, he had defeated a Bush. And there was a core group of people who are just, and they, again, were located in key states here, who just think the political system has passed them by, that it just does. It pays no attention to them. And again, I've talked about my experiences at these Trump rallies interviewing his supporters, and the thing they would say again and again is, my kids are not going to be part of the American dream. We're losing that. And Trump was the only person who came up there and spoke to them in language they understood. But that's easy to do as an insurgent candidate running against an establishment candidate. He's now in different circumstances, right? He is an incumbent. Yep. He's got to defend a record. And I just think he is not as comfortable. He's much better at purging the system than he is, you know, how do we do this metaphor now? Reconstituting the digestive system to be productive. That's
Farther down the column, Harris talks about going for the saltines and ginger ale to try to work your way back from the crisis, you know. And actually, maybe Joe Biden is saltines and ginger ale, speaking of mild approaches to things. But I'm wondering, you know, if this metaphor is applicable, clearly, I think anybody who's ever used Ipecac or enforced its use by a small child, let's say, the whole method here is designed to be very temporary. And I don't know whether that speaks to one term or two, but boy, I just wonder whether the country can continue the paroxysm for another 4 years. I mean, does the metaphor go that far, or am I stretching it here, Matt Dickinson?
I think he's a disruptive force, but after the disruption, people, they want to know what you're going to recreate, what you're going to build in the place of what you've torn down, and you know. Purging the system is the first step, but it's not. It doesn't get you back to health.
It's not the only step, for sure.
So, you know, 2020 is going to go a long way towards answering your question. Is America ready for four more years of disruption, or do they want to switch now? And again, it's not simply a referendum on Trump, although primarily, but Biden has to show that he is the saltines and ginger ale candidate.
What a slogan. the Ipecac president versus the saltines and ginger ale president.
It fits on a bumper sticker, so use it.
I'll tell you. I think there's a reason why John F. Harris is a widely read political columnist and generally regarded as a very astute journalist, is because he comes up with stuff like this occasionally that just makes you go, wow, I never thought of it like that, but the guy might have a point. So, he says, a president who makes us puke would be an improbable reelection slogan, but the emetic metaphor illuminates one way of thinking about the dire situation Trump finds himself in this summer, 5 years after it became clear his presidential ambitions were not a novelty, but a serious proposition, and 4 months before he faces voters again. And so I think that's where Harris is going here, is he sort of saying, is this, if this is the Ipecac candidate or president or whatever, do people really want to do this twice in a row? I think is, you know, one serious question out there right now. And I'm wondering, Matt, you look around the landscape here and you kind of see what some of the swing state polls are saying. Of course, the national polls don't really matter. And I think everybody immediately after reporting the national poll and what they say says, by the way, they don't matter because we have this electoral college system, which makes essentially us our presidential election 50 state contests. What are you seeing out there? I mean, advising Trump right now, would you be really, really worried, or only one really?
I'd be really, really worried, in part because of circumstances outside his control. I mean, the coronavirus and the impact on the economy, and whether that coronavirus which hasn't really abated, comes back in a way that makes these reopenings look foolishly premature. Like it or not, as the president, he's sort of held responsible for these decisions. And you could argue that's unfair, but that is not helping his ability to sort of mobilize or to repurge the political system. I mean, people want to know, what can you accomplish? We've got problems. What can you accomplish? It's not running against something now. He's running on what he can accomplish. I don't know if you saw his interview with Sean Hannity, but you could see Hannity's frustration on Fox News when they asked him, you know, what's this election about? What's your plan for a second term? And Trump struggled to answer that. That's not what you want an incumbent president to do. So I think it's really, really in trouble.
Yeah, that was a very striking situation, especially given the friendly confines of that interview. I mean, Hannity and Trump are very, very close, and to see basically the toughest question Trump get all campaign. I mean, or at least the question that worked out to be the toughest one, coming from Sean Hannity, I think just made it that much more powerful, frankly.
Exactly.
And you kind of have to look at that and go, yikes, this is really a serious issue. But, you know, when you mentioned the premature reopening theme here, the latest news out of the administration, at least as of yesterday, I mean, it's probably something new this morning, actually, but as of yesterday, the president and Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, were calling for schools to reopen, essentially, damn the torpedoes, we're going to reopen schools in the fall, and almost regardless of what is happening with the coronavirus. And is that more of the same? Are they just doubling down, or is there really an expectation that that can happen and that no problems will ensue? Or what's your read of that, Matt?
Well, I think he's signaling that we're returning to normalcy, and he's trying to emphasize the extent that he has a campaign strategy here is to emphasize the economic numbers, which, you know, are rebounding. Whether they'll rebound enough and quickly enough to help him is an open question, but he's trying to emphasize, okay, we're past the worst. We can start beginning to return to normalcy, and that includes sending our kids to school. Now, he doesn't have a lot of tools to make that happen. School is mostly a local jurisdiction decision and is a state-level decision. But he's trying to send that message out there to his people that, you know, we're returning to normal here sooner as opposed to later. And, you know, the worst is behind us.
And I wonder also, when you say that school reopenings are a local decision, I just can't imagine an education secretary and a president not recognizing that really reopening schools has to depend on local conditions, and that, you know, if local conditions remain the same as they are right now, reopening schools in Vermont might make sense, but a lot less sense in Arizona, right?
Yes. I mean, they have some tools at the federal level in terms of allocating education funds to exercise some leverage, but I think they're not going to do that. This was more rhetoric, I think, Dave, than anything. It was basically the president and Betsy DeVos signaling what they'd prefer to happen, telling their supporters, we think it's time for a return to normalcy, but they understand that in the end the decision is between the state and local governments.
But after a while, after all the statements how coronavirus was going to go away when the warm weather got here and it was just going to disappear at some point, and now we look at the statistics, and if anything, it's sort of, in fact, Arizona hit a higher peak yesterday than New York ever did at its worst, apparently. And they have this positive test results now of like 26% of the people who are getting tested out there are positive for the coronavirus. And you know, you look at figures like that and you just go, well, it's quite clear that this is not going away with the warm weather. I mean, Phoenix is famous for warm weather. I just really have to wonder, are people starting to wake up and realize that this is more of the same?
I think they are, but they're also saying, you know, how long can we go with our lives disrupted? It's difficult for people to maintain that sort of that discipline. And there's a pressure
on them. To suspended sort of animation, almost.
Yeah.
It is crazy situation. I mean, unprecedented, and last thing before the top of the hour, and that is this book that came out this week from Mary Trump. Is that going to have any impact, really, going into Donald Trump's background and all the allegedly damaged psychology and so on?
I think he is. His audience views towards him are built in, and the book will not affect much. I have not read the book, however, so that's mm-hmm. a caveat. But I think it will sell some copies. The people who hate Trump, it will reinforce their views. The people who like him will dismiss it as sort of sour grapes for somebody trying to make money.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, I don't think I want to be at that Trump family, the family Thanksgiving the upcoming. Or I doubt there will be one, actually, but that would be... I just can't imagine how that works in a family. And I guess basically we have a pretty dissolved family at this point. But anyway, that is clearly a lot of work by this Mary Trump, who I guess is a clinical psychologist by training, and had extensive conversations with family members about Uncle Donald. And that's what broke down or came to fruition this week. And we'll see if I don't know if it'll I kind of agree with you, Matt. I don't think it'll have much impact either, but there you go. Well, the 2020 campaign rolls on. To what conclusion we do not know, but I'm sure Matt Dickinson will be by to share further light on it in the not too distant future. Matt, thank you very much for joining me today. It's great talking with you.
Thank you, Dave.
Hey, let's call it a day on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And just wanted to mention, by the way, today we'll have Common Sense Radio coming up with Bill Sayre. Tomorrow, another news conference with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials. They've gone from a 3-times-a-week schedule to a twice-a-week schedule for these coronavirus 19 response news conferences. And so that'll be tomorrow after the Dave Graham Show. And Tuesdays and Fridays is the new schedule there, folks, just so you can keep up and keep listening to WDEV FM and AM. We'll be back tomorrow morning with another edition of our program. Really appreciate you listening today. Please do so again tomorrow. Have a good afternoon, everybody.